Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Legend of Takhti.
He was the best wrestler in Iranian history.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service.
Rumors spread that
he had been killed.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here is what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. The ongoing confrontation between the Maasai community and the government of Tanzania, ancestral ties on one hand and business interests on the other, and why Uganda's new teachers' bill has educators worried.
If we have to raise the profession to attract better teachers, then we must make it attractive. And we cannot make it attractive if it remains of low status.
It's Monday, the 26th of August. We start right here in Kenya. If you are a frequent flyer within the African continent and beyond, you've most likely flown on a plane owned by Kenya Airways, the Kenyan national airline. While the carrier has remained one of the major airlines on the continent for the last 10 years, the story behind the scenes has been far from rosy. A series of events such as high fuel prices, terror attacks, outbreaks of epidemics and pandemics, among others, came together in a perfect storm that made it impossible for Kenya Airways to make a profit for a decade. But this year is different if the recent announcement of a $4 million profit is anything to go by. Is it a signal of better days ahead? I went searching for an answer from the airline's CEO, Alan Kilavuka. So, Mr. Kilavuka, welcome to Focus on Africa. So, a profit at last. How are you looking at this result, given the story that we've been telling and the story that many people have heard about Kenya Airways in the last 10 years or so?
Yeah, so thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me here. And very pleased to be really announcing that for the first time in 11 years, we are at last announcing a profit. So this is very exciting. This is because of the plans that we've made, strategic plans that we've made to get here. So it makes us very proud of this moment.
Some people may look at it and say, I mean, it's just $4 million or just about that. It doesn't sound like a lot of money for a lot of people.
Well, it is, because it's the first time. You know, what we had promised everyone is that we were going to break even. And in aviation, your margins are very, very thin margins. So typically, you would have a net margin of 2%. It's lower than 2%, but it's a profit nonetheless. And again, like I said, it's within what we had promised the market and the public.
I can hear the audience shouting at me asking net margins, break even. What does that all mean?
So the margin is, if you take your profit, in our case, like you mentioned, $4 million, and then you divide it with your total income, that's what is called the margin. So that margin is, generally speaking, for aviation, about 2%, between 2 to 5%, no more than that. In our case, it's 0.6%. But what is more important is that it, you know, it's a profit, and it's a profit for the first time in over 11 years. And then, you know, break even is when your expenses and your income is even.
So let's look back at those 11 years then, because the company reported a lot of losses actually almost every year. What was ailing the airline, and why couldn't, you know, the management at the time, I know you are not the CEO for all that time, but why couldn't they get it right? Because 10 years is quite a long time.
Actually, the point of us saying this is not to say that management in the past was not making the right decision, but aviation, and in our particular case, is impacted by a lot of external factors. Every small factor has a huge impact on aviation because, like I mentioned before, our margins are very thin. So if your expenses bumps up because of an event, it impacts your profits. That's what has been happening in the past. There was an aborted expansion plan. We were trying to expand, 12 years ago. but it aborted because of a series of very unfortunate events, including the Westgate attack, the airport burning down, the Ebola epidemic. And then the impact of that continued to a point where in 2020 we had COVID. So we put up a plan from 2021 on how we will recover. And like I said, what we had promised the market is that this year we expect that we will have a profit, which we have been able to achieve at least for the half year. So now we're working very hard to replicate that success in the second half of the year.
So you've described a good number of external factors that may have led to the performance of the airline in the last 10 or so years. But were there some internal factors as well, things within the airline, maybe strategies that were not working that needed to be reversed?
Yes, of course, there are internal factors as well. So one of them, and the obvious one, is how we respond to those external factors, how quick you respond to them. So the basis was that we had a big plan of expansion. And when external factors start hitting you or start coming at you, then you are supposed to respond quickly, decisively, and radically. And so sometimes it took long to respond to some of those factors, when to shrink. So there was an attempt in 2017, for instance, to restructure the company, even the finances, and it worked to a certain extent, because even if you look at the history, you will see that's a point at which we made an operating profit, not an overall profit, but an operating profit. And then again, it was not sustainable. So for us, we have gone back to look at what are those things that ailed us and then work at them systematically. For example, how do we focus on customer, the schedule integrity? How do you spread out the business, invest more in other business segments, make sure that we have correct routing, the correct fleet, and the correct frequencies?
Let's then talk about maybe what you'd call key moments in the story of the airline for the last decade or so. What are some of the key moments, the things that you would say have contributed to what we are seeing now?
I'll not go way back. I'll just start in 2021. We started something we call Project Kifaru. We are restructuring the airline. We had certain elements. We looked at the network. We looked at the fleet itself, the aircraft that we're flying. And then we looked at the people. And what we were trying to do is to optimize those three things. In other words, are we flying the correct network? Are we flying the correct fleet in terms of number and type? And are we doing in the right frequencies? So we had to rejig that. And then we had a very severe look at costs. We renegotiated all our leases. And of course, COVID helped because it was easier to renegotiate when there was a COVID situation. We looked at how productive our assets are. In other words, how much you're able to milk your assets to generate income. And by here, your assets include your people. And then we looked at the culture of the people, make the people more accountable and proactive, have them look at more innovative ways of responding to situations. So that was a whole program or a whole restructuring plan that we laid out. We have been able to achieve most of them. We estimate about 95% of it. There are elements of them that we have not been able to achieve. And that is why you've seen this positive return. However, for this to be sustainable, we also need to structurally look at how the company is financed. And that is now what we're calling Project Kifaru 2.0.
The airline has been depending quite a lot on the Kenyan government, which is the majority shareholder at this moment. And we've seen a series of bailouts being discussed before and money being pumped into the airline. There have been a lot of questions whether public money needs to be spent to keep the airline afloat. You've also been talking about getting an investor. How will that change the business and bring you more stability?
I think what I'd like to say here is all the money that government has extended to Kenya Airways is in form of loans, not grants. So in other words, we will be paying back that money to the government of Kenya. So it's not sunk money, number one. And the second more important thing is that the airline plays a very pivotal, very catalytic role in terms of economic development. So the contribution that we make from an economic development point of view is significant. And that's why governments around the world support their airlines so that they can continue playing that very key and important role. Now, of course, as a responsible organization, we need to make sure that we are also able to pay our bills. So the government, yes, has been supporting us financially, mainly because the company is actually undercapitalized. In other words, it needs injection of capital from its owners in form of equity. What we have been receiving from government up to now is loans. But if you look at how much loans versus equity, you find that we are very heavily geared towards the loans. What that means is that we spent a lot of money in paying interest on the loans. So we want to reduce that impact. And that is why we are looking for a strategic investor so that we can reduce the ratio of debt versus equity, because the new investor pumps in equity. And then, of course, we're able to receive cash. And this new investor also will bring in new thinking, fresh thinking, hopefully world best practices to help us in our growth story. Growth can only come if you have sufficient capital for growth and if you have also injection of new ideas.
And looking ahead then, talk to me about how you see competition panning out in the, you know, aviation space in Africa. And I'm asking this because there are also other sort of national carriers that are quite successful that have had a very different kind of story than what KQ has had in the last 10, 15 years. I'm talking about airlines like Ethiopian Airlines that seem to be, financially speaking, quite more successful than Kenya Airways or South African Airways. How do you see yourself continuing on this journey of being able to recover in the face of very strong players that are sort of seem to have agreements with their governments that work? They seem to have their investors in order. They seem to have their network in order and things like that.
It's very important for the government to support the aviation sector. In places where you see aviation or airlines are successful, the government of that country has crafted policies that emphasize the importance of aviation in that economy. And that is why, you know, you mentioned a few of those airlines. Even if you look at the Middle East and other places, you will see that aviation is front and center of the economic development agenda. That's what needs to happen for aviation to have a sustainable growth story. Now, Africa, you mentioned Africa, you talked about competition. Actually, what Africa needs more than even seeing how they can compete is collaboration. Africa, first of all, is underwhelming in terms of air transport. We only have 2% of global traffic. What we need is about more than double digits, more than 10% of global traffic. And the only way to do that is Africa works together, just like other continents have done. We come together as airlines and build more formidable airlines, because the bigger the airline, the more formidable it is, the more sustainable it is.
Alan Kilavuka, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Charles. Thank you very much.
Alan Kilavuka, the CEO of Kenya Airways. The Maasai community in Tanzania continues to protest against what they call forcible evictions from the Loliondo and Ngorongoro areas in northern Tanzania. This latest wave was triggered by a government plan in 2022 to relocate the local community from their traditional home in the conservation areas to a town 400 kilometers away. The areas had been earmarked by the government for conservation and tourism projects. The exercise was meant to be voluntary, but the Maasai say its execution has been nothing like that. Those opposed to moving have reported harassment and destruction of their property by the Tanzanian authorities. The Maasai further claim attempts by the government to deny them services such as health, education, and the right to register as voters. For more on this, I've been speaking to Moses Joseph Oleshangai, a human rights lawyer who grew up in Ngorongoro.
The Maasai of Ngorongoro are not complaining that this land is not enough, or saying we can no longer share with the wildlife. They have never put that question. It is the government saying Maasai are becoming so many. I say, yes, the Maasai population is growing, but has not grown to the extent of becoming incompatible with any of the interests in the area. Like, it's not an issue of competition between wildlife and people and nature. It is the problem of the business overriding the interests of human rights and overriding the interests of even of conservation.
Elaborate for me that business interest that you've described then, the tourism angle. There's been tourism, but there's also been talks of conservation and the need to conserve the area.
One is, yes, you have the people who have demands. One of it is the land. And you have the people practicing pastoralism, which the grasses is a factor. And you have the wildlife, of course, sharing the same interests. So the major economy of the Maasai share almost with 80% of the wildlife who actually also consume the grasses. nature determines what happened in Ngorongoro, for example. Like the movement of the wild beast is determined by the nature. So they keep migrating. And the time they arrive, the master will have to squeeze the livestock into some other areas. Then the moment the wildlife turn around to Serengeti, the master will come back into the plains. So it's not the issue of competition. The master have studied this nature over centuries, and to them is not a problem. Yeah, to us, is not a problem. Now, coming to the tourism, because some people saying it's the demand for conservation. If the issue is conservation, then the last people you can fight with is the Maasai, because to be able to survive into this ecosystem, you need a place that guarantees survival of animals, including cattle, because they're animals. So the Maasai will be the first people to protect the nature, because it is not only for the commercial demand which the government has, but actually for their own livelihoods, for the culture, for the spiritual issues which is entrenched into the system. The problem is you have the people with the business mindset who see conservation as beneficial because there is a return for financial gain. It's the people who can only conserve if there is money coming out of it. And now they think the presence of the Maasai might be affecting their business.
So tell me then, Mr. Oleshangai, how do the Maasai, because you've said your community has learned how to conserve this nature with your own methods, how have you traditionally done it to make sure that this ecosystem is not getting depleted? And why, in your opinion, is it so difficult for you to explain to the government of Tanzania, for example, that you can do it, there's another method to do it, and your method is better than what they are proposing?
So how the Maasai do it is, these animals, the time they arrive in the course of the migration, they transmit disease. So the Maasai have to run into the highlands, which the animals never go, so that they survive with their cattle. After late April, the Maasai will go back to the plain, because the migration has also turned into Serengeti, then to Maasai Mara. So there is not issue completely of competition with the resource. So the time they migrate, even the Maasai, is to allow the highland to recover. So they go to the plain, which they will go back to the highland in November to allow the wildebeest to come, to allow again the recovery to take place. Ngorongoro is the only place, even the government can say, you have over 100,000 people, but with zero poaching. The people who never consume wild meat is a taboo.
Tell me about this, if there is a disconnect between what the Tanzanian government is saying and the global conservation partners. And I'm asking this because Ngorongoro, it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And UNESCO have told us in a statement that they uphold the rights of people like yourself, indigenous communities, to access their land. Is there a disconnect?
From 2008, in every report that UNESCO have written about Ngorongoro being a World Heritage Site, they have questioned about the population, telling the government they should address it, without saying what are the standards that the government should employ in addressing that question of populations. Then when the problem now comes, and actually we filed a case in East African Court of Justice, and I was the lawyer representing the community, government responded in a court case saying, whatever we are doing, it is a recommendation from UNESCO. We put that question to UNESCO, and they say, we are not responsible. I showed them, actually, January, February this year. They actually visited Tanzania with the request from the government. They never met the real people who are affected by the policies. And you have a place you call a World Heritage Site without taking into account the interests of and the welfare of the real people on the ground who do not referring like a cradle of mankind of the past. It is their home, which I think is the very problem of this internationalism. Idea of like you just ascribe some areas like belonging to the world without going first and asking the people affected by that. Ngorongoro is the only place in Tanzania that the government has not budgeted any coin, one shillings. They have not budgeted any, not like allocating. They have not even attempted to budget. 2 weeks ago, the National Electoral Commission issued a public plan for voter registration countrywide. Of course, in the exception of the Ngorongoro division, 25 village, 11 wards, 96 sub-village were all totally excluded from the voter register.
You are a lawyer, but you're also a member of the Maasai community. You connect in, you know, very strongly to this land and to the people and to what's going on there. If you were to package for us a solution in very few words, what would that solution look like for you?
One, the notice that delisted the village should be revoked legally because it was a legal process, should end legally. Second, the right to vote is guaranteed by the constitution. But coming to the conservation, the solution to this conservation narrative is we know the government is interested with the money. They can concentrate with the money. They can leave the management of the Ngorongoro to the Maasai because they have interest of keeping it alive because it also benefits pastoralism, which is the major economy of the Maasai.
Moses Joseph Oleshangai, a human rights lawyer in Tanzania. Now the Ngorongoro Conservation Area is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. We reached out to them for a response, and this is part of their statement to us.
UNESCO is deeply concerned about the population relocation of the Maasai people from Ngorongoro Conservation Area World Heritage Site carried out by the Tanzanian authorities. The organization has never at any time asked for the displacement of the Maasai people or other local communities.
We've also asked the Tanzanian government to respond to the allegations of denial of services to the Maasai community, and they are yet to get back to us. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.
And now to Uganda, where a new law affecting the country's education is in the offing. It is called the National Teachers Bill, and if passed to become law, will require all teachers in the country to have a bachelor's degree within a period of 10 years in order to continue teaching. The Ugandan government says the bill aims to improve the standards of education in the country. The teachers, however, think the requirement to have a bachelor's degree for everyone is a tall order, urging the government to improve on their welfare first. Some of the other proposals include strict penalties for unlicensed teachers and the establishment of a National Teachers Council to regulate the profession. Let's now hear from one of the teachers in Uganda.
My name is Isingoma Hassan Tembo, a teacher by profession and teaching in a secondary school in Kampala City. We are not welcoming this whole idea. I started with a diploma. The government employed me with that diploma. I decided to upgrade to a degree level, thinking that maybe after upgrading, probably my remuneration will improve a bit. It didn't. Not until I was forced again to upgrade for master's with the same mind of, you know, better salary pay. It didn't. But right now, I'm doing my PhD. Now, we have been having an issue with the same government or ministry, let me say, that every time they advertise for teaching jobs, they do not give teachers with degrees. They do not give teachers with masters because they claim those are overqualified. They end up giving teachers with diplomas. Now we are wondering why this bill now claiming that you want all teachers to have a degree, even at primary level. What's the reason behind that? I do not support it. They might force it onto the teachers, but I have a feeling that so many teachers are going to opt out of teaching. Because first and foremost, they are paid peanuts, especially those at primary level. Now, that will simply mean that they must upgrade. Upgrading will mean they must use their own money, which they may not afford. If maybe the government comes out open and sponsors those very teachers they want to upgrade, other than that, it will not work. Teachers are going to run out of teaching.
To explore these concerns further, I spoke to Baguma Philbert Bates, the General Secretary of the Ugandan Teachers Union. He started by explaining what the bill is.
I think there is a lot of misinformation surrounding the national teachers pay. The 10 years grace period within which teachers are supposed to get degrees, the counting has not started. The National Teachers Bill was approved by Cabinet on 1st April 2019. Within the National Teacher Policy, there is a provision for creation of a professional body, which is the National Teachers Council, which will be created by an act of parliament. When the Teachers Bill was introduced, it is going to be discussed by stakeholders and people will give their input. Finally, when it is discussed and approved and the president assents to it as an act of parliament, then the counting will begin from there. And therefore, it is not true that come 2030, every teacher will be expected to have a degree in order to teach in Uganda.
Right. So then, talk to us about what the requirements are. You've talked about there will be a 10-year grace period and, you know, the countdown begins once the president assents to the bill. What is it that the teachers have to do within those 10 years and are they comfortable that they should be able to achieve what's being required of them within those 10 years if approved?
First of all, for us as teachers and the teaching fraternity, we have nothing wrong with upgrading our status to being graduates, but we want government to do first things first. For some time now, we have been demanding that government improves the welfare of the teachers. Government came from nowhere and brought a decision that was uncalled for, which was dividing teachers according to the subjects they teach. They increased the salary of science teachers by 300%, leaving all other teachers of primary and those of humanities and arts with zero enhancement. This is what is concerning the teachers right now. And therefore, government must first improve the welfare of the teachers, then request the teachers to go and upgrade, and the teachers have no problem with that.
Yeah, and that's the point I was trying to understand. But help us understand this then. What are the current qualifications for somebody to be able to be a teacher in Uganda? I know it does vary depending on the level of education that you're looking at, but broadly, what are the basic levels of qualifications that people need?
Right now, for you to teach in a primary school, you need to have a grade 3 teacher's certificate. And for you to teach lower secondary, which is O level, you need to have a diploma. For you to teach higher level, which is A level, you need to be a graduate. But you will realize that even that is the arrangement, you find in primary we have graduates, but they continue to pay them as grade 3 under the guise that they are highly qualified compared to where they are teaching.
So I'm then thinking for that first class of teachers that you described, the grade 3s, what would it take for an individual with that kind of qualification to be able to actually get a bachelor's degree? And given the circumstances that you're describing as, you know, the welfare of teachers not being looked at properly in Uganda, would they be able to do that, to achieve that qualification, get a degree within the 10-year period? It doesn't matter when the government starts counting, but is it possible within 10 years?
That's why we are saying government must do first things first. You first improve their welfare, and once the welfare has been improved, then they are able to do it. It is a matter of enrolling in school, and then, first of all, as we talk now, someone who is 50 years and above, this policy may actually find him or her when he or she is naturally exiting at the mandatory retirement age of 60 years. And therefore, right, it is possible within 10 years, if the teacher's welfare was improved and the teachers have capacity, it is possible.
So what prompted the government then in Uganda to propose this kind of law? And what specific challenges will the law solve if it comes into place?
The teachers or the teaching profession is the mother of all professions. But again, in terms of status, it has remained with low status because of the minimum qualifications needed for one to become a teacher. And therefore, if we have to raise the profession to attract better teachers, then we must make it attractive. And we cannot make it attractive if it remains of low status. Number two is to regulate. The teaching profession is one of the professions which are not regulated in this country. Nobody can tell you the number of teachers in Uganda and where they are. Yes, I am on record. Nobody has the exact number of teachers in the country, because those who have registered are either in active teaching in public or private. Others are in doing other things. So you cannot know who is there and available to teach. And therefore, the creation of this policy where there will be a body to regulate the teaching profession is another way of regularizing and professionalizing the teaching profession.
So there are bits of this proposal then that you seem to be quite happy with.
Oh, yes. I am also happy to belong to a profession that is well regulated, which can attract the best of the country's human resource, where professionals are practicing their profession and enjoying their profession.
And are there other provisions that you are supporting that you think will improve the quality of education in Uganda?
Of course, right now, the institutions which have been providing degrees in education, like, you know, universities come up with their own course units and end up taking them for National Council for Higher Education. They are accredited and they start teaching. Now the provision will be that for you to get out as a teacher, you must be measuring almost the same standards, especially when it comes to the internship. That means we are going to have a professionalized teaching fraternity, but also we are going to deal with masqueraders. In Uganda, there is a tendency that anybody can teach because there are so many people who are standing in front of learners. They have never been to a teacher training college, but they are masquerading to teach. And therefore, with the regulator, that will be no more. The teaching profession will get its position very clearly and will stand out as one of the prominent professions. And it will attract very good human resource, because once it is streamlined, then everything will be online and it will operate smoothly.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bates, for sharing your thoughts on this.
You are welcome, sir.
Baguma Philbert Bates, the General Secretary of the Ugandan Teachers Union. Focus on Africa was produced by Bella Hassan and Connie Sharp in London. Frenny Joey was in Nairobi. Patricia Whitehorn was in charge and Philip Bull was the technical producer. Our editors are Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi. I'm Charles Gitonga. We'll speak again next time.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles, from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.